must study the desktop, which had almost nothing on it, other than a bright lamp, a letter opener, and a magnifying glass. He opened the drawers and found billing orders and invoices. All of it was for tea. It still told him nothing about Lucy. "What was Newman doing here?" he asked aloud again. He opened the deepest drawer of the desk, which contained a series of vertical files. He scooped the entire set of files out with his hand and stared at the bottom of the desk drawer. "Fool me once," he said. Using the letter opener, Frost pried at the wood panel on the bottom of the drawer, and it came up easily. Immediately underneath the panel was a manila envelope. He retrieved the envelope, opened the flap, and dumped the contents across the surface of the desk. Behind him, Jess sucked in her breath. "The son of a bitch," Frost said. 43. Photographs. The envelope contained dozens of photographs. Frost picked up each picture and laid them out in rows, taking up the entire surface of the desk. He spotted at least five different women among the faces. He didn't recognize any of them, but Jess leaned over his shoulder and jabbed one of the photos with her fingernail. "That's Marilyn Summers," she said. Newman had at least 30 photographs of his former neighbor. He'd stalked her everywhere she went, on campus at SF State, at a library computer, singing in a church choir, drinking coffee with friends on Market Street. The zoom lens he'd used captured every detail of her body and face in intimate, uncomfortable detail. Frost could see the brightness in Marilyn's distinctive blue eyes and the pencil-thin lines of her eyebrows, the curves of her hips and frayed jeans, and the ebony shine of her long, straight hair. She was magnetic, and she'd attracted the wrong man. There were more pictures of Marilyn. After, she lay on her bed, naked. Her blue eyes were fixed, staring in death, mouth open. Blood stained her body like red paint where the knife had violated her. Newman had recorded the murder in the same horrifying detail he'd used to stalk her. "Do you know the other women, Jess?" Frost asked. She didn't answer immediately. Her eyes couldn't let go of the photographs. "That one there, I think that's the girl in Green Bay who was killed when Newman was 18. And this other one, that's his classmate at college in Boulder. I don't know the rest." She leaned closer to the array of pictures. "Wait, no, I know that girl, too. She's local. A prostitute. She disappeared 9 months ago, and a couple of the other street girls reported her missing. We never found her." "She doesn't fit the pattern," Frost said. "There are pictures of her after the murder, but not before. Eddie hid the body rather than let us find her, like the others. I wonder why." "I know why," Frankie murmured. Frost turned around. Dr. Stein had crept up behind them. Her lips were pressed together in horror as she stared at the photos laid out on the desk. Rain dripped from her hair to the metal floor like music. "He made a joke about it," she said. "He talked about using a hooker to get a sperm sample from Leon Willis, and about how he would have had to get rid of the hooker if he did that." "And you didn't think that information was worth sharing with the police?" Jess asked acidly. Her brown bangs fell in front of her eyes. "He put it in a speculative context, not as a confession. It was all what if. There wasn't enough to break privilege, even though my gut told me that he was telling the truth." Jess pounded out of the storage unit with loud, heavy footsteps. Frost knew she didn't cover her anger well. "There wasn't anything I could do," Frankie said to Frost. "I'm sorry." "What else do you see in these photographs?" he asked her. "What do they tell you? I need a read on this man, Frankie. I need to know what he's really doing." "Well, for one thing, it's pretty obvious why he stopped here that night," Frankie told him. "Why?" "He was going to Berkeley to have sex with Simona. He stopped here first to look at the pictures." Frost was puzzled, and then he understood. "My God, this is what turns him on." "Yes." "What else? Get inside this guy's head." He knew that was the last place she wanted to be, but she bent over his shoulder until she could make out every detail in the collection of photographs. Then she turned around and studied the rest of the storage unit. The crates, the yellow walls, the tea and the pill bottles. the rain pouring across the open doorway. "Something's wrong," she said.
"What?"
"I don't know. You wrote that down in the note I found in your office, too. Something's wrong. What did you mean by that?"
"Just that I can't make all the pieces of the puzzle fit. I mean, most of them do, but there's one piece that feels like it comes from a different puzzle.
I'm sorry, I know that's not helpful. Right now, I don't care what doesn't fit," Frost told her.
"What does fit?"
Frankie hesitated.
"The knife."
"What do you mean?"
"He's consistent. Newman uses a knife on these women."
"So?"
"Todd talked about seeing a knife. He remembered seeing a knife the last time he was taken."
"The last time?" Frost said.
"You mean when the Nightbird took Lucy?"
"Yes. I'm sorry."
"What does that mean?" Frost asked.
"I'm not sure, Frost, but he says the game's almost done, and now there's a knife in the mix. He always uses a knife. It tells me we need to find Lucy soon, before something happens to her."
Frost got out of the chair. He took a long, hard look at the women pictured on the desk, their faces, their smiles, and then their bodies, riddled by knife wounds. He had a brief, grotesque image of Lucy in the same position. He thought about Darren Newman standing over her with a camera. After. His anger consumed him, and he felt powerless. Then Jess walked back inside the storage unit through the waterfall of rain.
"Let's go," she said to him. "I've got a forensics team on the way, and the boy outside will keep this place secure until they get here."
"Go where?" Frost said.
"The Nightbird just turned his phone back on," Jess told him.
"We got a ping."
The GPS signal took them to one of the neighborhood's ruined industrial sites. It was a three-story building stretching the length of a football field. The walls were red brick, modeled by decades of salt water carried off the bay. Round arched windows lined the wall facing the street. The ground floor glass had been replaced by heavy plywood, and above it the windows were pockmarked with cracks and bullet holes. A barbed wire fence surrounded the entire property. They parked a block away. Lightning lit up the night sky in streaks above the angled roof. Frost could feel the thunder under the street. He left Frankie behind in the Suburban, and he joined Jess and half a dozen other officers as they converged on the shell of the building.
"He knows we're coming," Jess reminded him.
Their flashlight beams led the way through the rain. They followed the fence along the exterior of the building, and when they reached the back corner, they found a section of netting that had been cut away, opening up a way inside. One by one, they pushed through the gap in the wire. The building wall was in front of them, and the plywood blocking the first window had been splintered with an axe, which lay on the sidewalk.
"Welcome to the party," Frost murmured.
Jess went inside first. Frost followed. The stone floor was a minefield of debris. His light passed over rusted tools, jagged chunks of mortar fallen from the ceiling, and garbage left behind by squatters who'd broken in over the years. Concrete support columns with peeling white paint made a row of soldiers from one end of the building to the other. The wind whistled like a ghost through broken windows. Standing pools of black water reflected the glow of the flashlight. He smelled mold and dampness in the shut-up space. It was cold. Jess sent two officers along each of the perpendicular walls. She and Frost picked their way through rubble toward the center of the building. Each step dislodged rats, who squeaked and scurried. Rain squeezed through the ceiling. Drip, drip, drip. They didn't hear anyone else inside the ruins. Ahead of them, open stone steps led toward the building's second floor.
"There's a light up there," Jess murmured.
Frost saw it, too. The light went on and off, throwing moving shadows above them. Jess took a step toward the stairs, but she didn't have her flashlight aimed at her feet. Frost did, and he saw something in her path half concealed by a grease-covered towel. It was gray metal, and it had teeth. He shouted for her to stop, and Jess put her foot down short of the towel, but the toe of her boot kicked the device forward. A metal bang rocked the space as the iron mouth snapped shut.
"A bear trap," Frost said.
"That was meant for us." Jess hissed into her radio.
"Everybody, watch your step. We've got booby traps in here."
And then to Frost.
"This is a setup. We're getting out.
You go. I'll check the second floor."
"Frost, he's not here. He lured us inside to make us targets."
"Lucy might be up those stairs," Frost snapped.
I'm ordering you out. Frost shook his head. No way, Jess. I leave when I know the place is empty.
He stepped over the bear trap and marched toward the stairs, using his flashlight to sweep the floor as he did. Behind him, he heard Jess exhale with a loud sigh. She barked into the radio again.
Hold your positions. Do not move.
Jess followed him. On the stairs, his flashlight lit up dust and broken glass. He saw glints of gold. The stairs were lined with long brass tacks, all of them pointing upward. He took the steps one at a time, knocking the tacks aside with the side of his boot as he went. They tumbled downward.
Watch out, Jess, he murmured. I see them.
The light above them got brighter. The shadows got larger, dancing on the stairs. He saw an electric lantern hanging from the ceiling on a hook. The wind through the holes in the wall made the lantern swing back and forth, like a man dangling at the end of a hangman's rope. At the top of the steps, Frost found the front half of a rat, severed from the rest of its body. 2 feet away, the rat's back half spilled blood over the claws of another bear trap. Jess caught up to him and saw it too. This guy is nuts. Not nuts. Angry. They cast their lights around the building. The glass in the arched windows was mostly gone here, letting in sheets of rain. Thunder boomed like an earthquake over their heads. Dust and paint flecked from the ceiling. As the thunder quieted, he heard another kind of muffled thunder, louder and closer. A strange, snickering scrape joined the chorus, like fingernails on chalkboard. Something was alive in here. Jess heard it, too. And they both turned their flashlights toward the ceiling and flinched. Sagging water pipes hung from the mortar. Lining the pipes, thousands of seagulls squeezed together, causing a rumbling noise with the shifting and rubbing of their wings. Their claws restlessly scratched on the metal pipes. As the light hit them, dozens flew toward the open windows in panic, and others spread their wings wide and screeched, their cries amplified into screams between the building walls. "You a Hitchcock fan, Frost?" Jess asked.
"Not anymore. This guy's not here. Let's go. These birds look hungry."
"Wait," Frost said. He stopped and listened. Fighting with the cacophony of the gulls, he heard music close by. It started as low as a whisper and grew steadily louder. The song was sweet, but to him it was sickening. It was Nightingale. He swept his flashlight around the building again, but saw nothing. The song came from in front of him. He headed toward the far wall, ducking gulls that swooped past his face. Slick guano covered the floor. At the wall, a rounded gap for a missing window looked out on a deserted parking lot and the street below them. A heavy plank had been nailed diagonally across the space to prevent someone from falling out. He moved his light along the floor and found a cell phone lying on the floor near a glistening pool of rainwater. The phone's ringtone continued to sing. Nightingale. Over and over. The phone was ringing. Jess came up beside him.
Nothing we can do but answer it.
Frost bent down and snatched up the phone. He answered the call, but he didn't say anything at all. He waited.
You took the bait, the nightbird chanted, but now you're too late.
And then another song began. It wasn't Carole King. This song was hard rock, played so loudly that Frost had to wrench the phone away from his ear. He put it on speaker, and he and Jess listened to a synthesizer thumping out a chorus. No words, just the beat. It annoyed the birds, who screeched in protest, and their cries became deafening.
What the hell is that song? Frost asked.
I know it.
This guy has a nasty sense of humor, Jess replied. It's the Edgar Winter Group. The song is Frankenstein.
Frost didn't get the joke at first, but then he did.
Frankie!
He splashed through the water to the giant window and looked down at the street. He could see his SUV parked at the end of the block. As he watched, the driver's door flew open. Francesca Stein climbed out, slammed the door shut, and ran. 44. Frankie thought to herself again, something's wrong. She felt as if she were in a strange bubble inside the SUV. Streaks of rain covered up the windows so that she couldn't see the street,
and all she could hear was the hypnotic drumming of the storm on the hood. Her wet clothes felt cold, and she sat and shivered. She kept the doors locked. She turned the key in the ignition and ran the windshield wipers long enough to see through the glass. Down the street, the police disappeared inside the building through a hole in the fence. She was on her own, and all she could do was wait, but waiting wasn't something she did well. She didn't like the idea of putting her life in anyone else's hands. She adjusted the mirror and looked at her own reflection. Her wet hair ran down her forehead and face like snakes. Shadows brought out the bones of her face. Her dark eyes stared back like the eyes of a stranger. She wished she could see behind them. For all the time she spent in the minds of other people, she didn't really know herself. Something's wrong. What? Her phone pinged with an email, making her jump. She saw the glow of the screen on the seat next to her. He was still with her, still stalking her. She didn't want to pick it up, but she had no choice. She checked the email, and the return address was the same as it had been in the beginning. The Nightbird was writing to her again. It all comes down to this. He was right. One way or another, this all ended now. She leaned forward to watch the silhouette of the ruins a block away, and somehow she knew it was all a ruse. The white room wasn't inside that building. Neither was the Nightbird. Neither was Lucy Hagen. He'd lured the police there because in the end, this came down to the two of them, and no one else. She waited impatiently, knowing another email would follow soon. Seconds passed, and her phone pinged again. She's waiting for you. Lucy Hagen was in his hands. Another patient. Another death. More blood. She didn't know how much more loss her conscience could stand. She could see their faces in her brain. Monica Farr, Bryn Lansing, Christie Park. She could even see the face of Marilyn Summers in the photographs that Frost had laid out on Darren Newman's desk. Marilyn Summers alive and Marilyn Summers dead. Frankie could have stopped him, but she'd let Darren fool her, the way he fooled everyone else in his life. He'd seduced her mind and almost seduced her body, too. It ended now, tonight. He emailed her again. Another ping. You're the only one who can save her. She knew she should alert Frost. She could get out of the car and scream for the police. End the ruse. Get them out of the ruins. Her voice would bring them running. They could save her, but they couldn't save Lucy Hagen. And it would start all over again with someone else. She wasn't going to let that happen. She finally sent an email back. I'm right here. You know where I am. Frankie held her phone in her hand, and she waited for him to reply. The silence went on and on. No email. Nothing. It was a slow torture, as if he wanted her to suffer in anticipation. Finally, her phone vibrated. She sucked in her breath, realizing that he was making a video call this time. He wanted to see her, and he wanted her to see him, too. That was part of the game. She wished she could throw the phone out of the car into the rain, but she held it up in front of her face and steeled herself as she answered the call. There he was. The mask. Everyone else had seen it before, but not her. Frost, Todd, Lucy. They'd described it to her and shown her pictures, but the reality was 1,000 times worse. Close up, filling the entire screen. The plastic was deathly white, drained of all color. Candy red lips grinned at her, a huge grin, stretching from the point of the chin to the high, false cheekbones. His teeth looked like gold railroad tracks. The eye holes were rimmed in silver. And where the eyes should have been was the gleaming black mesh of an insect's eyes. Dreadlocks dripped down the mask in braids of fake hair. The mask spoke to her. Frankie! Frankie! She knew he could see her, and she wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of letting him see how terrified she was. She made her own face into a pale mask, her lips curled with contempt. Where's Lucy? Wanna see? Wanna see? Show me. Like a page turning, The camera reversed. Frankie couldn't help herself. She cried out in anguish at what she saw. The screen blazed with whiteness, as if the luminous ivory paint on the walls could blind her. Everything was white, walls, floor, and ceiling. In the midst of it, she saw Lucy Hagen. Tears, like rain, streamed down the young woman's face. The huge whites of her eyes matched the walls. Frankie knew she was drugged, hypnotized. So far into a trance that she stood on the surface of another planet, it was the look that her patients had when she was working with them to change their memories. But this was the dark side. This was everything she'd ever tried to do in life, turned against her. Lucy had both hands wrapped around the black handle of a knife. Its silvery blade was almost a foot long, its razor point facing downward. Her arms were outstretched from her body. Every muscle trembled. She stared into the camera, her glassy eyes helpless.
"Help me," she called, with the whimper of a child. "Save me!"
Then she screamed, so loudly that Frankie jerked back in her seat.
"Stop me!"
Frankie could barely hold the phone in her hand. She wanted to run to Lucy and gather her up in her arms.
"Let her go!" she shouted into the phone. "Let her go! Take me! I'm the one you want!"
The camera reversed and the mask came back, grinning at her with its red lips. Behind the mask, the Nightbird laughed. His laughter bubbled up from his throat and filled the SUV, getting louder. She could still hear Lucy in the white room.
"Save me! Save me! Save me!"
"Where are you?" Frankie yelled into the phone. "I'll come to you. I'll let you do whatever you want. Let Lucy go." He kept laughing. The call ended and the screen went black. The Nightbird was gone.
"No!" Frankie shouted. "Tell me where you are!"
She waited. Her breaths were short and fast. Her fists tightened the way they would around the man's throat.
"Come on, come on, come on,"
she murmured, knowing he wasn't done with her, waiting for the next email. Ping. She whipped her fingers across the screen.
"You have 5 minutes."
Frankie punched back her reply in capital letters.
"Where are you?"
The seconds ticked. 1, 2, 3, 4. She rolled down the window and rain poured inside. Where did he want her to go? What did he want her to see? She leaned out and looked up and down the street. She was alone. Ping. Another email.
"Only you can save her."
"I know that," she shouted out the window. "Don't you think I know that? Tell me where you are." Her fingers trembled as she typed a message.
"I will come to you. Please, I will do whatever you want."
1 minute of her 5 minutes was gone. Frankie cried. Sobs racked her chest. That was what he wanted, to torture her. And this was how he did it. Not by laying hands on her body. Not by feeding drugs into her brain. He made her sit in the truck, impotent and desperate. He let the time go by, until there was no time for her to stop what came next. To pry the knife out of Lucy's hands. Ping. She read the email through her tears.
"Look up."
Frankie pushed her head out of the window of the SUV and craned her neck to stare at the cloud-layered sky. It was night. Lightning flashed. Silver curtains of rain descended.
"What am I supposed to see?" she shouted.
But then she saw it. She was across the street from a 4-story white stone building. It looked like a government palace, airlifted out of Washington, D.C. Columns divided the rows of windows. A balcony jutted out from one window as if Evita might stand there, waving to adoring crowds. But this building, like everything else around her, was abandoned. Dirt marred the white stone. The windows were covered over. Everything was dark. No, she realized as she looked closer. Not everything. Where she'd seen nothing before, now a pinpoint light blinked on the top floor. It flashed behind the center window, on, off, on, off. A message. That's where he was. That's where she had to go. She threw open the door of the car. Frankie climbed out, slammed the door shut, and ran. Frost climbed into the open window frame. He braced himself against the walls on either side, and delivered a kick to the diagonal plank that was nailed across the space. The first kick splintered the wood, and the second dislodged it from the side of the building and sent it spiraling to the ground. Behind him, Jess shouted, but Frost simply took a step forward and jumped. The ground didn't look far from the second-floor window, but it felt far as he dropped. He picked up speed and landed on his feet with an impact that shuddered through his spine. One leg crumpled under him, and he collapsed to the ground, which was a rocky slope of dirt and weeds. He got up and half-limped, half-ran toward the locked gates. Jess yelled from the window, "What the hell are you doing?" Frost pointed at the white building on the far side of the street where Francesca Stein was disappearing inside. "There!" He reached the property gates, which were 8 feet high but free of barbed wire. He dug his shoes into the mesh and climbed. His fingers slipped on the wet netting, and spasms shot up and down his legs. He reached the top, wobbled, and basically let his body fall to the street on the other side. "Frankie!" he shouted, but she was already out of sight. He dragged himself toward the building's main door at the street corner. A block away, he heard police officers sprinting to catch up with him. He limped up the outside stairs to a boarded door, which flapped open and closed as the wind blew. He wrenched it open and saw elegant marble steps in front of him, making a spiral toward the upper floors. Concrete dust littered the stone. Picture frames hung askew on the walls. Heels tapped over his head, climbing the stairs. "Frankie!" he called again. "Stop!" She stopped, but not because he'd called her. She stopped because at that moment a guttural scream filled the entire stairwell. It came from speakers. It came from everywhere. High above him and right beside him, he heard a man's wail, throaty and terrible, begging for mercy that never came. It began, cut off, and began again, and died away into the gasp of someone laboring to breathe. It was a scream he'd never heard in his life, but there was no mistaking what it was. It was a scream of death. 45. Frankie heard the scream. She froze halfway between the second and third floors of the building. The agony of it made her cover her ears. She fell against the railing and couldn't take another step. The sound pushed through to her brain, no matter how much she tried to keep it out. If you came to the end of the road and saw the devil standing in front of you, that would be the howl of despair bang from your throat. She wanted to turn back, but a woman's voice rose over the scream. It was Lucy.
"No! No! Megan, stop!"
Frankie shook off her fear and bolted up the last few steps. She found herself in a long hallway, with closed doors stretching the length of the building. The noise came from everywhere. She didn't know which door to choose. She tried the first one, and it was locked. They were all locked. She went from door to door, shouting Lucy's name. Halfway down the hall, she found an open door, and she burst inside. Her heart stopped. Whiteness overwhelmed her. What she'd seen on her phone didn't compare to the dazzling shock of white above, below, and around her. She had to stop to adjust to the brightness. It made her want to shield her eyes, as if she were looking into the sun. White room, white lights, every window covered in white. The room was large, at least 100 feet from end to end. The ceiling was low. Video projectors, all white, had been mounted in intervals around the entire room. The walls were screens. The ceiling was a screen. The floor was a screen. She realized in an instant that this was a room that could be turned into anything. Any scene out of the pit of your imagination. Any dream come to life. It was a room where all your deepest fears could come true. There were three people in the torture chamber. In the corner, 20 feet away from her, was Todd Ferris. He was alive. He sat on the floor, knees pulled up to his chest. He had his fingers laced together, his hands against his chin, as if he were praying. As she ran into the room, his head swiveled, and he stared directly at her, but he didn't act as if he recognized her. His winsome face looked dazed. His eyes were wide, unblinking circles of disbelief. She thought he was drugged, like Lucy. Lucy Hagen stood in the center of the room. Her mouth hung open. Her breathing was loud, as if she couldn't drag air into her lungs fast enough. Her legs were slightly apart, and Frankie could see them trembling. She had the pretty face that Frankie remembered, but the face didn't even belong to Lucy anymore. She looked like someone else entirely, someone who'd been thrown onto an island alone. One of Lucy's arms hung limply at her side. The other held the long-bladed knife. Her elbow was cocked, and Lucy clenched the black handle as if it were part of her body. The blade of the knife wasn't silver anymore. It was soaked in blood. Lucy stood over the body of a man. He was the third person in the room. He lay back, draped across a chaise that was an exact match for the one in Frankie's office. This was her office, taken to a violent extreme. The man's arms and legs sprawled off the chair. His fingers and shoes grazed the floor. The gruesome, grinning mask half-covered his face. It was Darren Newman. She recognized the wild, bright colors of his clothes. He wore a bright yellow dress shirt, but the yellow was dyed crimson where he'd been stabbed multiple times. His chest heaved. Blood seeped from his body onto the white chair and onto the white floor, dotting it with red beads. He was on his last gagging breaths. Bile spat from his lips. His skin grayed as oxygen fled. The Nightbird was dead. He'd lost the last game. And yet the game went on. "Lucy," Frankie murmured, "it's okay. I'm here. You're safe." Lucy saw her, but she didn't really see her. She stared down at Darren's body with a crazed disbelief. Frankie walked across the room, moving closer to her step by step. "There's nothing to be afraid of now, Lucy. Put the knife down. Let me help you." "No," Lucy whimpered. "No, please. Don't make me." She got closer and closer. "Lucy, it's Dr. Stein. You are Lucy Hagen. Do you remember? You're okay. You went through a terrible thing, but now you're okay." Lucy kept the knife poised in her hand. Then slowly, horribly, she put it to her throat. Frankie walked faster, holding up her hands. They were only 20 feet apart now. "Put it down, Lucy," Frankie told her softly. "Just kneel down and lay the knife on the floor. Nothing will happen to you." Lucy sobbed inconsolably.
"No, no, just go away. Don't come any closer. I don't want to do this."
"I know you don't, and you don't have to."
"No, you don't understand."
Frankie heard thunder on the stairs of the building. Voices shouted. Frost was almost here, and he wasn't alone. In seconds, the police would storm into the room. They'd have guns. And Lucy still had the knife pressed against her trachea. She had it pressed so hard that Frankie could see blood seeping from her skin around the edge of the blade. If she pushed any more, she'd sever her own throat. Calm. All Frankie could focus on was calmness. She wanted Lucy's entire world to be calm. She took another step, and another. She made her way around the far side of the chair where Darren's body lay. She wanted to draw Lucy away from the horror at her feet. And as Frankie walked, Lucy turned. She followed every step that Frankie made. It was just the two of them now, confronting each other. Lucy held the knife. Frankie held her hands up. They were 10 feet apart. "Lucy, it's me. Do you recognize me? Do you remember me? I'm here to help you. I know you're afraid, but believe me, it's over. It's done. No one will hurt you anymore.
Stay away from me."
Lucy's hand shook. She could barely hold the handle now. The knife twitched at her skin.
"Lucy, it's Dr. Stein. Give me the knife. You don't want to hurt yourself. I know you want everything to go away, but you don't have to do this. It's already over. You're already safe.
Take the knife away from your throat, okay? Just let your fingers loosen, and it will fall to the ground, and it won't hurt you or anyone ever again, okay? Listen to my voice, Lucy. Don't pay attention to anything else. The only thing you hear is the sound of my voice."
Lucy was hypnotized, but Frankie tried to take over, to break in, to snatch her away from the Nightbird. She held Lucy's eyes and didn't blink. She kept the same cadence in her words, as lulling as an ocean wave.
"My voice, Lucy. Listen to my voice."
The thunder drew closer. Footsteps pounded outside the door. She heard Frost calling now, shouting from the hallway. He called Lucy's name, but Lucy didn't hear him. She was trapped in another world and couldn't escape. Frankie wanted to shout for them to stop, to stay away, to leave her alone. But she couldn't break the connection with Lucy. She didn't know what would happen when the police came in. She didn't know what the chaos would do to the girl's brain. The knife was still in her hand. It was just a small motion away from cutting her open.
"That's all you have to do, Lucy. You don't have to do anything else at all. Just listen to my voice."
Frankie took another step, just one step. And then the hell began. She heard a metallic click below her as she triggered some kind of electronic switch under the floor tiles. Lucy heard it too, and terror consumed her face as if she knew what that click meant, what it would bring, what it would do to her. The Nightbird was dead, but he still controlled the game. Hard, loud rock music filled the room. Frankie knew the song and knew it was a sick joke. She'd been teased about it all her life. Frankenstein. The entire room transformed around her. The cameras awakened automatically, and ultra-high-definition images swept the space. The white walls, white floor, and white ceiling mutated into a landscape so real that she felt as if she'd been lifted out of San Francisco and carried thousands of miles away. Cold air blew from hidden vents. The temperature dropped like a stone. They were in the mountains, as high as God. Craggy pinnacles rose on every side toward a gray sky. Snow clung to furrows in the rock. Far below, hundreds of feet below, a glacier crawled between the hills, calving icebergs into a ribbon of seafoam green water. Between two peaks, a perilous footbridge sagged into the arms of the air, hanging on the thinnest of wires. Lucy stood on that bridge, frozen with fear. Frankie shouted, "Lucy, it's not real!" But to Lucy it was real. She was there, on the bridge, living her nightmare. "You!" Lucy screamed, her voice rising over the music. She stared directly at Frankie and knew exactly who she was. She'd been waiting for Francesca Stein. She'd been programmed for this exact moment. "You did this to me!" "Close your eyes, Lucy. Close your eyes. We'll make it go away. Together." The Nightbird's sing-song voice chanted from overhead speakers. "Lucy, Lucy." "Don't listen to him," Frankie called to her. "You're safe. Just close your eyes. He can't hurt you anymore. The knife is the key. Set yourself free." "No, Lucy, close your eyes. None of this is real." From the doorway in the corner, the police stampeded into the room. Frost, Jess Salceda, four uniformed officers. They saw the body and the blood. They saw the knife in Lucy's hand. They drew their guns. Chaos descended. Shots rang out. The music throbbed. Everything began to spin out of control. That was just what he wanted. "You did this to me!" Lucy screamed again at Frankie. She stared down at the bridge under her feet, which looked as if it would give way when she took a single step. She swept the knife away from her throat and brandished it like a weapon with her arm held high. "I'm going to kill you!" 46. Frost saw the gun in Jess's hand, pointed at Lucy's chest. "Jess, don't shoot! Don't shoot! All of you, back off!" He knew none of them would stand down. If it had been a stranger standing there, not Lucy, his own gun would have been in his hand. They wouldn't let her out of their gun sights. Not while Lucy held the knife. Not while she was threatening Frankie. Not while there was a stabbed body in the middle of the room. "Put down the knife right now!" Jess barked. Lucy didn't hear her. Her eyes were locked on Frankie. Her hand quivered around the knife. For a long, fragile moment, nobody moved. Frost sized up the room. He saw Todd Ferris in the corner, watching the events unfold from behind fixed eyes. He saw Darren Newman sprawled on the chair, his chest a sea of red. Newman wasn't moving or breathing. Frost looked down. He felt as if he were standing on a glass platform suspended from the mountaintops, with the winter landscape below his feet. Frigid air rolled over his skin. If it felt real to him, he knew how it felt to Lucy, locked inside her trance. Lucy, with her fear of bridges. He gestured one of the officers. "There must be a control panel in one of the other rooms. Get out of here and find a way to shut off this damn music and turn off the cameras." The officer glanced at Jess, who nodded. He holstered his weapon and retreated from the room. Frost took a step toward Lucy, but Frankie lifted a hand to stop him. She shook her head, but she kept her eyes on Lucy. "Don't do it, Frost," she called. "Anything could set her off." "Lucy!" Frost called, trying to cast his voice above the pounding music. "Lucy, it's Frost!" "She can't hear you," Frankie said. He didn't care. He needed to reach her. The guns were still trained on her heart. "Lucy, come on. Let's get out of here. Shaq wants to see you. You can stay at my place tonight. We can watch the city lights through the window. We can just sit there, you and me, talking. What do you think?" Somewhere inside her head, he knew she had to hear him. But nothing he said reached her. "Lucy!" he pleaded again. He thought he saw a glimmer of hesitation in her face. But then the Nightbird's voice interrupted from the speakers. The awful sing-song cadence rose over the music. It was too late. He watched Lucy's mind breaking into glass pieces. "Can you fly? Can you fly? Will you die? Will you die?" "Stop it!" Frost hissed under his breath. "Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! It's up to you. You know what to do." High on the imaginary bridge, Lucy shook her head back and forth over and over. "No, don't make me. Please don't make me." "It's up to you. You know what to do." "Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. You know what to do. You know what to do. I can't. I can't. No, please. Please." "The knife is the key. Set yourself free. The knife is the key. Put it down," Jess called again, her low voice a warning. She knew they were running out of time. "Put the knife right down, Miss Hagen. Nobody wants to hurt you." "Lucy, the knife is the key. Set yourself free." Then everything happened at once. Lucy screamed like a war cry. She pushed off her feet and charged at Frankie. Lucy was on her before the police could take action. And with the two women locked in a knot, no one could shoot. Lucy stabbed with a knife. Frankie held her arm back. They twisted, circled, and stumbled, battling hand to hand. Frankie was taller and stronger, but Lucy had a fever of adrenaline. Frost ran. He needed to get to them now, while there was no clean shot. It wasn't far, not far at all. He could cross the distance in 5 seconds, but he didn't have time. 5 seconds was too long. Lucy charged into Frankie's body, and Frankie lost her balance and tumbled backward. Frankie had nothing to break her fall, and her head cracked against the stone floor. Lucy leaped. 3 seconds. 2 seconds. It was still too long. Frankie couldn't fight back, couldn't lift her splayed arms. All she could do was stare helplessly at the girl kneeling over her. Lucy clasped both hands around the black handle and hoisted the knife high over her head. Frankie's chest was below her, skin and bone and heart, defenseless. 1 second was all Lucy needed to swing the knife downward and bury it in Frankie's body. But 1 second was too long. 1 second was all Frost needed to reach Lucy and pull her away, but 1 second was too long. Lucy was still there in that frozen moment, knife over her head, poised to strike. In that second, the music went off. The screens went blank. The room fell silent. The mountains, the glacier, and the bridge disappeared. Lucy blinked, as if waking up from a dream. Jess fired. 47. The first bullet struck Lucy in the muscles of her right shoulder. Her hand froze. The knife slipped out of her fingers and clattered to the floor. A second officer fired in the same instant. His bullet hit Lucy in the side, under her rib cage, penetrating kidney and bowel, and exiting out her back and slamming into the wall. The third officer fired and missed her head by less than an inch, but the damage was done. She was on her knees when Frost reached her. Her eyes blinked in confusion. He eased her onto her back, and he took off his jacket and propped it under her head. He found the wound in her side and kept pressure on it to stanch the bleeding. Lucy stared at him.
"Frost?"
"I'm right here, Lucy."
"Did you get me off the bridge?"
"Yeah," he told her, giving her a smile he didn't feel. "Yeah, you're safe now. Nothing to worry about. No bridges."
"I can't move," she murmured. "It happens like that sometimes. The fear overwhelms me and I get paralyzed. Don't worry, though. It always goes away. I'll be fine."
"You'll be fine," Frost said. She closed her eyes. Time passed slowly as he waited for the paramedics, and all he could do was stare at her face and watch her steady breathing. Warm blood pushed between his fingers. He didn't know how many minutes had gone by when he felt a hand graze his shoulder. It was Frankie.
"Let me take over, Frost," she told him. "I'm a doctor, remember?"
Are you okay?
I'm fine. I want to help.
He let her trade places with him. He got up from the floor, but he didn't go far. He stood with his arms folded tightly across his chest. The pain at the base of his neck had become needles pressing everywhere into his skull. As he waited, Jess came up next to him, close enough that her shoulder brushed his arm. They stood silently for a few seconds.
"You know I didn't have a choice," she said.
Frost didn't answer. She was right, but he couldn't bring himself to say it. Not yet. He didn't blame her. If anything, he blamed himself. History was full of bad moments that should have gone differently.
"None of this is your fault either," Jess told him.
He still said nothing. He didn't want her to think he was being deliberately cold, but he had nothing to give. Jess got the message, and she left him alone. He watched Frankie, who looked up from Lucy and gave him a reassuring smile. It was a smile without the distance he usually felt from her.
"She'll make it," Frankie told him. "These wounds aren't fatal."
Not the bullet wounds, Frost thought. He didn't know about the wounds inside. It was cruel enough to torture a person's body, but it was even worse to torture someone's mind. There was no surgery for that, no gauze pads to press against the blood, no stitches. He began to understand the temptation of manipulating someone's memory to make the past go away. He wondered if, given the choice, Lucy would want to forget everything. Erase the last week of her life that began on the bridge with Bryn. Forget the Nightbird. Forget Frost, too. Then he stared at the stark white walls and thought, "This is what a blank slate looks like. This is the emptiness that's left when your memory is gone." It didn't seem any better than the alternative. Finally, finally, he heard sirens drawing closer. The police officer who drove Frankie home loved to chat. She wasn't in a mood to talk, but that didn't bother him. His name was Harmon Krug. He was one of the largest human beings that Frankie had ever met, with a chest so deep that he had trouble turning the steering wheel. He was bald, with no neck and hands that resembled baseball gloves. He slouched in his seat to avoid grazing the roof of the car with his head.
"So you're a shrink, huh?"
Harmon asked, in a voice that had its own amplifier.
"Messing around in people's heads, that's gotta be weird. Most of the people I meet, I don't think you'd want to take a good look under the hood, know what I mean?"
Frankie didn't answer. She closed her eyes and leaned against the cold window of the squad car, but Harmon didn't take the hint.
"I guess everybody's a freak about something. Hell, it's San Fran. People say we got more than our fair share of the weirds, right? I've got a brother who lives in North Dakota. Him and his family come out here, and they watch the Pride Parade, and they can't believe it. Of course, then he calls on Christmas, and he tells me they're eating lutefisk. You ever had lutefisk? Soak fish and lie until it's some kind of jelly? No, thanks. That's weirder than anything you'll find in the Castro District."
Frankie couldn't help but laugh. It felt good to let go of some of the stress of the past week.
"I suppose you deal with phobias and stuff," he said.
"Sometimes."
"Spiders, snakes, germs, all those?"
"All those," she said.
"Sidewalk cracks," Harmon said. "Are there really people who can't walk on sidewalk cracks? What's that about?"
Frankie sighed. "Phobias aren't rational, Harmon."
"Yeah, but sidewalk cracks?"
"Usually it's a question of association," she explained. "Maybe you were a child who used to hide in your closet when your father came home drunk and violent. Later on in life, you find yourself experiencing intense claustrophobia. You can't be in a room where the door is closed. To your brain, those places take you right back to that closet when you were a kid."
Harmon pursed his big lips. "Huh."
Outside the squad car, they passed Union Square. She could see her office building and the dark windows on the top floor where she had her practice. A parade of patient faces passed through her mind. Not just the recent stories, Monica, Bryn, Christy, Lucy, but many of the people who had been in pain, with fears taking over their lives and making it almost impossible for them to function. She told herself that she'd helped them. She wanted to believe that, but she wasn't sure anymore.
"Almost home," Harmon said. "You're going to get wet."
The rain kept on, sheeting across the windshield of the squad car. Rivers ran through the street gutters.
"That's okay."
"Hell, we need the rain, right? All these years of drought, and we're finally getting some payback. My brother talks about the snow they get in Williston. 2-3 feet at a time. No thanks. His kids love it, though. My brother sends me pics of them out in the yard building snowmen and snow forts.
Frankie smiled at the thought of kids playing in the snow. And then, strangely, her heart raced. A heaviness weighed on her chest, and she found it difficult to breathe. It was as if she were buried in cold, white snow. Harmon stopped at her condo on O'Farrell. A torrent separated her from the doorway of the building, but she didn't care. She needed to get inside.
"This the place?"
he asked. "This is it. Thank you for the ride, Harmon." Frankie climbed out into the deserted street. It was very late. The police officer waited while she swiped her key card to enter the building, and then the squad car peeled away. Her heels tapped on the tile floor of the foyer, but she could hardly put one foot in front of the other. She realized how bone-tired she was, but this was more than exhaustion. Her heartbeat drummed in her ears, louder and louder. Dizziness rolled over her like a wave, and she put one hand on the building wall to steady herself. The elevator arrived, and she crossed paths with a stranger. He gave her a charming smile, which looked like the smile of a man who'd gotten lucky tonight. He was still dressed for work, with his suit coat slung over his shoulder and his crisp white dress shirt unbuttoned at the collar. Frankie got in the elevator. As the doors closed, she watched the man in the white shirt head for the street. All she could see was his white, white shirt. All she could feel was the heaviness of snow. The elevator climbed. As it reached the top floor, she watched the doors open, and then she watched them close. She rode the elevator all the way back down to the lobby, and still she couldn't move. The doors started to close again, but she blocked them with her hand and she got out. She stood, alone, dripping, on the stone floor. She was utterly unsure what to do. She had the same uneasy sensation that had drifted like a fog around her brain for days. Something's wrong. But now she knew what it was. 48. Frost slouched in an uncomfortable chair in the hospital cafeteria, with his legs stretched out and a cup of coffee cradled in his hands. He had a vending machine hot dog on the table in front of him. It tasted like sawdust. The overhead lights had been turned down, leaving him in shadow. The restaurant was empty overnight, except for a maintenance man pushing a wet mop around the floor. He saw Jess in the doorway. The lieutenant went to the vending machines and bought herself a package of mini donuts dusted with sugar. She joined Frost and sat on the other side of the wide table from him. She ripped open the package and popped a donut into her mouth, then licked the sticky tips of her fingers. She was small and heavy, but she had a fierce charisma. They sat across from each other in silence. Frost finished his hot dog. Jess ate her donuts. He found himself staring into his coffee cup, rather than at her, but Jess stared directly at him and waited. Sooner or later, she knew he'd talk to her. Eventually, he met her eyes. They knew each other well. You couldn't look at someone the same way after you'd seen them naked. It was like taking off a superhero's mask. He and Jess didn't love each other, and there were days when they didn't even like each other. They were oil and water, but it didn't matter. They would always be connected, more than most cops, more than most friends. "You doing okay?" he asked her. He knew he wasn't the only one who was struggling. Jess had pulled the trigger tonight. No cop did that without going through hell. It didn't matter who was on the other end of the bullet. Frost had never faced that split-second choice, or the consequences that came with it. "Not really," she replied. "I know you had to do it, Jess. If you didn't, Dr. Stein would have taken a knife in her chest. Lucy wasn't Lucy. I know that, too, but it doesn't mean I'm not going to see the girl's face when I close my eyes. She was an innocent kid, and she was a friend of yours. I'm sorry, Frost." It took a lot for Jess to say that, and they both knew it. Jess locked up her emotions behind her badge. She had only one philosophy on the job. You do what you have to do. You make the tough choices because no one else will.
You talked to the doctors? She asked. Frost nodded. The outlook is good, but the surgery will take several more hours. Keep me posted. I will. Her parents are on the way. I'm waiting for them. You want me to talk to them? Jess asked. No, I'd like to do it. Whatever you want. She studied him up and down. You look like you could use a doctor yourself. They should run a CT or an MRI on that thick head of yours. Frost smiled. Yeah, soon. Jess got up from the chair. She headed for the door, and his eyes followed her until she was gone. They'd said what they needed to say to each other. They'd had disagreements over the years, but they always made peace. He lingered in the cafeteria. His headache was back, and he popped more Advil. He thought about Lucy on the operating table, and he pictured the faces of the women in the photographs in Darren Newman's storage locker. Victims. Lock it down, Jess would tell him. But he felt a wave of anger at the world. That was how he'd felt when Katie died, too. Frost? He looked up in surprise. Francesca Stein was in front of him. He hadn't even heard her as she walked across the cafeteria floor. Dr. Stein, he said, dropping into her formal name again. She wore the same clothes she'd worn all evening. She hadn't been home. I thought I asked an officer to take you back to your place. You did. I needed to see you. He gestured at the chair that Jess had left pulled out, and Frankie sat down. She laced her long fingers together and looked uncomfortable. It was a strange look for a woman who always seemed in control of things around her. He could read trouble in her eyes. What's bothering you, Frankie? I wanted to talk to you about something. I think there's a problem.
What kind of problem?
She leaned back in the chair and put her palms flat on the table. Her fingers were slim and long. Even when she was wet and upset, she had a precision about every motion she made. Do you remember what Darren Newman was wearing tonight? She asked. Orange shirt, black pants, some kind of psychedelic tie. That's right. Frankie didn't say anything more. Her lips were pressed together.
Is that supposed to mean something to me? Frost asked her.
I'm not sure. Frost smiled. Look, it's been a long night for you. Maybe you should get some sleep. We can talk things over tomorrow.
No, I don't think this can wait. Tell me something, do you have any police officers searching Darren's house?
Near the panhandle?
Yes, there's a team there now.
Are you able to reach them?
Frankie asked.
Sure.
What is it you're concerned about?
I was hoping they could text you a picture of Darren's living room and bedroom.
Frost cocked his head.
Why?
I'll explain when I see it. I could be completely wrong about all of this, but I want to be sure.
She was upset enough that he was willing to indulge her. He called the head of the forensics team and put in a request for photos from inside Newman's house. Less than 90 seconds later, his phone began to chime, and he downloaded a series of pictures of the house from multiple rooms and multiple angles. He handed his phone to Frankie, who scrolled through the photos. The more she did, the more her face darkened. Finally, she handed him his phone again.
Well? Frost asked. Do we have a problem?
Yes.
Okay, what is it?
She breathed in and out, and then she said, When Darren first came to me, he told me a story from his childhood. He grew up in a rural area not far from Green Bay. He was an only child. When he was 7 years old, he built a snow fort for himself during a Thanksgiving Day blizzard. The fort collapsed on him. He nearly suffocated and died before anyone realized what had happened. A lot of the stories he told me in therapy were lies, but that one was true. His mother showed me a newspaper article about it.
Frost shrugged. Must have been scary for a kid, but I hope you're not saying it excuses the monster he became.
No. No, that's not it at all. Do you know what leucophobia is?
I don't.
It's a pathological aversion to the color white, Frankie said.
That's a real thing?
Yes, and it can be triggered by exactly the kind of experience that Darren went through as a child. The color white becomes a symbol in the brain of the near-death experience he went through in the snow. That was all he could see as he tried to breathe. Nothing but whiteness. So the color brings back the terror. You think Darren Newman suffered from leucophobia? Frost asked.
He never talked to me about it, and I didn't catch it at the time, but yes, I think so. I never saw him wear anything except brightly colored shirts, his car candy red,